Today on Maine Calling, the midlife years. How would you describe the phase of life you're in? Are you young, old, somewhere in between? That in between is referred to as midlife. Some people pin midlife to the ages between 40 and 60. One influential study says it's much broader, from 25 to 75. Whatever the age, midlife has a bad rap. It's often followed by the word crisis. But is that fair? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we discuss midlife. It is a complex time when we are generally wiser and hopefully a little more financially secure, but it often brings more responsibilities and physical challenges. The good, bad, and ugly of midlife. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn more at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. Welch and Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. There are life phases that are distinct, like childhood and old age, but that big stretch of life in between, midlife, makes up so much of our lifetimes, yet gets less attention. Today, we'll talk about what it means to be middle-aged and how to navigate some of the challenges and joys of this significant period of life. Joining me, Anne-Marie Ahern, who is a writer, founder of Saltwater Farm Cooking Schools, and she helped start the Midlife Conference. This year's Midlife Conference is in Rockport from October 25th to 27th. Dr. Susan Wary is a geriatric psychiatrist and director of Aging Me, or Aging Maine, and she is associate professor of geriatrics in the College of Osteopathic Medicine at the University of New England. And Bruce Thompson is a professor of psychology at the University of Southern Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you consider yourself middle-aged? What do you think is difficult or enjoyable about midlife? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Anne-Marie, what gave you the idea to start a conference? Was it something going on in your personal life that said, I have a feeling people need to come together and talk about this?
Well, first of all, just wanted to say thank you for having me on the show. I've been listening to the show since I moved to Maine 15 years ago, so it's a real honor. I think, put simply, I had a lot of questions about midlife, and I didn't feel as though they were being answered in any traditional setting. The conference was sort of a means of helping people answer those questions in a safe place where they could be a little bit vulnerable and have conversations that were relevant to their everyday lives and some of the challenges and joys that present themselves at this stage of life. So that's sort of the impetus for the conference.
And to you, Anne-Marie, and I'm going to ask Susan and Robert, you all the same question, which is, and Bruce, what is midlife? I've seen so many, in doing research for this program, I've seen so many definitions, from 40 to 60, from 25 to 75. What made you feel, Anne-Marie, as though you were in midlife as opposed to no longer a young person?
Well, first of all, I'll say that for the conference's sake, we say that midlife is a state of mind. So it's up to you. And last year we had at the conference people as young as, I think, 31 was our youngest and 76 was our oldest. And the people that were a bit younger were, you know, brought their notepads and were really curious about what was ahead of them. And the people in their 60s and 70s had a lot of perspective that they offered those that were younger. So that was really wonderful. For me, I would say I started to feel like I was in midlife a few years ago when I noticed some pretty significant physical and emotional shifts. And I couldn't make sense of them. And they felt sort of out of character. And so I wanted to explore them with others. So that's how I ended up in this
Bruce,
stage.
thank you for being open about that. Bruce, I'll ask you, what do you think of as midlife?
I sometimes worry that I'm suffering from arrested development because I haven't I'm in my well into my 50s and I still haven't felt like I've truly become a midlifer. Now that could be a problem, but I'll think about it. I'll ponder that as we go. But it's a very slippery concept because I did a back of the envelope calculation based on the median life expectancy of men and women, at least in the United States. If you do the math, 39.5 is your statistical probable midlife, and that would really cause a fright for most people because they usually think of, well, I can still call myself midlife into my late 50s. And in fact, you just cited that wide range. It's another way to think about it from a kind of a psychological standpoint is it's like a projective test, which is a term we use when you're asking somebody a question and they're really projecting their own perspectives and their worries and anxieties onto it. So you could ask anybody between probably 30 and 60, and they're just going to throw out as an answer the collection of worries and concerns and aspirations. So it's a moving target, I guess, is what I would say.
Susan, your turn.
Yeah, I would agree. It's a moving target as a social construct, and it changes. It has changed in my lifetime. I think I have the distinction of being the oldest, therefore the most perspective among your guests on this call. And it's really quite extraordinary, isn't it, to talk about median ages, to talk about the life expectancy that one predicts when one sees one's friends and family beginning to age more noticeably, if you will, and also begin to experience those first intimations of what Erikson called intimations of mortality, right? I mean, women now can expect, to live into their mid-80s, and men perhaps a little younger than that. So I, like Anne Marie, would call midlife a state of mind, but it is that period of time in which one begins the reevaluation. One feels a certain amount of liberation. One has a certain number of accomplishments. One begins to observe changes in one's body, but perhaps even more in one's parents. And so you are faced anew with the reality of the limitations that we are, in fact, limited by destiny and by death. And so you start to reappraise. I think for me, that's kind of the nature of that state of mind is the beginning of the reappraisal process, and then the liberation follows.
The reappraisal, then liberation. I like that. They're both positive words. Anne Marie, I have to, I'm chuckling at Bruce's saying that 39.5 is halfway because I remember very clearly when I turned 40, people asked, "How do you feel?" And the most overwhelming feeling I had or thought that I had was, boy, I thought I would have it all figured out by now. Like, I really was very surprised that I didn't have it all figured out. And so, Bruce, you saying arrested development makes me feel a little bit better. But, Anne Marie, is this something that you're hearing from the speakers at your conference, from the participants at your conference? Is like, wait a minute, it was supposed to get easier.
Yeah, I think that for a lot of our speakers, they help our participants go through the processing of understanding how they arrived at midlife and really going through, the memories of youth and adolescence, their 20s, which informs them a little bit more about how they sort of arrived somewhere in the middle. And then from there, we help people intentionally move forward. And give them, more tools to consider the life ahead. So it's funny you said that about, thinking you'd have it all figured out by 40. I think up and I'm 43 years old, and up until this point in my life, I was very focused on achievement. Maybe I will liken myself to a hamster on a wheel. But now I feel more interested in self-reflection and sort of being a little bit more observant of what's around me. And I think there's a lot of value in having conversations with the community about this because it helps give you a little perspective. We tend to really be in our heads about this sort of thing. So
Susan, I see you nodding. This is what you're saying.
This is what I'm saying. And I think that there is a way at which, again, whatever age it happens, at 40, at 50, at 60, where you do develop this appreciation for shifting focus. You know, you've described it, Anne-Marie, as sort of the hamster on the wheel, and is saying, wait, life isn't just about doing. Life could also be about being. And what does that look like? I mean, I quite frankly used to describe turning 60 as being the new 20. And I'll tell you the reason that I used to say that is because at 20, I felt poised, right, ready to go make my mark on the world. And I had my whole life ahead of me. And frankly, it's exactly how I felt at 60, because I had a lot of things figured out by 60, had a much more stable self-image, and a lot of years ahead. So it really is interesting how we can experience this psychological growth across the lifespan.
Bruce, I learned recently about the U-curve. Explain to people what the U-curve is and how that applies to midlife.
Well, yeah, the U-shaped curve is a statistical phenomenon. And it comes up in all sorts of research from infancy all the way through later life. But it's the idea that there's some level of functionality or competence that's at the low end of the curve. And as you go up, you can start to peak. But after the crest, there's a decline. But that point in the decline, or the peaking and plateauing off, you're poised to find new ways to rediscover your own competencies, gain new skills, and so forth. With infants, for example, they'll show remarkable rapid growth up that curve. And then it's not so much a U-shaped curve, it's more like a series of U's, but they keep going up and up, like sort of like a very gentle stock market where there's ups and downs, but mostly moving up. And you can have decreases, you have striking decreases in your ability to cope. But once you would adapt to new demands and what have you, you can often have, people would call it almost like a paradigm shift or a different reframing of how you even approach problems. A lot of that comes up in my area of research, which is dealing with metacognitive growth and development. And you can find the curve returns to an upward trend, which is very, powerful. It's very exciting.
So what you're saying is, if someone finds themselves in midlife and maybe feeling lost or feeling like they're not at the place that they thought they would be, that really maybe what they are just around the corner from a big steep upward where they're going to they're almost like a blank slate ready to move forward.
Yeah, well said. Susan alluded to this a bit ago when she mentioned Erikson, who is a really famous lifespan stage theorist about identity and so on. And his idea of crisis, which I'm sure we'll talk more, we'll really unpack crises, I'm sure, in this session. For sure, getting through a crisis is the growth process for discovering the new ways of even seeing yourself. And some theme that may also be really fruitful here is self-compassion. Erikson's seventh stage of identity development is called generativity versus stagnation. And most people read that as a polarity where, ooh, you really need to get your ducks in a row and focus on how you can be generative. And that's a lot to do with establishing a legacy and giving back and so forth. Stagnation sounds terrible. You can't put a good spin on the word stagnation. But if you reframe it, you can think of it a time where you can start to, I don't want to use the word forgive, but forgive yourself, but show some self-compassion and realize it's okay to let go of those overly ambitious things you promised yourself all your young adult life. Like, I guess I won't climb Mount Everest. I'm not going to sail my boat across the Atlantic. I won't publish that book that I dreamed I would, that kind of thing.
Anne-Marie, I love that Bruce brought up the word crisis, because often, I might even say usually, when you hear the word midlife, it's followed by crisis. He or she is going through a midlife crisis. And I'm wondering if you think of that as a real thing.
You know, it's funny, so many people accidentally call our conference the midlife crisis without even second guessing themselves, which I get. It's definitely a cultural phenomena. You know, I like to think that midlife has a lot of opportunity to for growth, and a crisis sort of implies like a falling off or a decline. So I'm gonna say no, we'd like to take midlife in a new direction away from this notion of a crisis. I mean, you certainly have a lot of realizations in midlife, like you said, that maybe, you know, you're not going to get where you thought you were, but oftentimes there's so many opportunities that you just couldn't see before because you didn't slow down enough to take the time to look. So yeah, I think, you know, through a number of different difficult subjects at the conference, we'll try to explore some of those doors for people.
All right. And Bruce, I'm going to go back to you because I think often when people think of a midlife crisis, they think of the guy who's bought himself a convertible, left his wife, and is dating someone 20 years younger. Help dispel that notion for me. How real a thing is that? And what do you think of this sort of cultural stereotype?
Well, that is indeed that stereotype of the perplexed, confused guy going through midlife crisis time. And what you just described, that is a sort of wild stereotype, but there's a kernel of truth in everything that we hold, you know, close as cultural stereotypes. So the crisis in a more scholarly sense is some social, emotional, cognitive transformation where we have to reevaluate. We've used that several times now, this idea of reevaluating. And when you go through a crisis, not in the sort of horrible emotional pain sense of crisis, but a forcing yourself to readdress what your skills and aptitudes are, really taking stock of what you have in front of you. That's a crisis, but in a very growth-oriented one. So Erickson and other, you know, late life, well, mid to late life researchers have often talked about that being necessary. They're healthy experiences. So there's different forms of the word crisis. One thing that's just on a funny light note, and it goes back to self-compassion. By the time you're 40 or 50, it's finally safe to go to your high school reunion, because in the prior years, there's a lot of anxiety about comparison and competition. Like, oh, everyone who's, you know, at their 10th year end of, you know, high school reunion, they have beautiful children, their career is taking off, they're blossoming, and they look fabulous. And I won't match up. By the time you're 40s and 50s, everybody's had some kind of really tough thing go down. Divorce or a sickness or death in the family, loss of a job, substance abuse, something's happened, and everyone's now on an equal playing field. So although that's just a silly light remark, it has a deeper connotation around who we are and what we're willing to sort of say, it's okay. I'm going to take stock of what I'm good at. I'm going to move forward and release myself of some of these unreasonable expectations.
We get more real. And Susan, I want to go to you before we go to a break. When you hear that someone's going through a midlife crisis, what do you think? And what do you say to that person?
You know, like Anne-Marie, I think that the term crisis is so overused. So I try not to react to the term for starters. But I do think there is something real in the disruption of the status quo. And I always say to that person that any disruption in the status quo, any unsettling, does become a sort of inflection point. It becomes an opportunity for growth. And in fact, without it, without that disruption, growth probably doesn't happen. So I'm with you, Bruce. I think, you know, that a certain amount of disruption, that's what I would prefer to call it, is necessary and desirable for the next growth spurt. I think perhaps we're going to have somebody talk about gender differences here, Jennifer, at least I hope so, because, you know, Bruce, a lot of the way you describe the high school reunion strikes me as very much the way a guy would approach going to his high school reunion. Who's doing better than me? And am I doing as well as everybody else? I've never been to a high school reunion, but I've always imagined it as being an opportunity to see people I haven't seen for a long time, full stop, and not so much this comparison thing. So I found that fascinating. Don't know if it's gender, don't know if it's personality, but it really struck me.
Well, we'll talk some more about gender differences in midlife in just a minute. We do need to go to a break. We are talking about midlife on Maine Calling. Do you have some thoughts about this? Do you feel as though you're in midlife? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Our topic today, that long period of life called being middle-aged, the pros and cons of those midlife years. With me, Dr. Susan Wary, Director of Aging Maine and Associate Professor of Geriatrics at the University of New England. Bruce Thompson is a Professor of Psychology at the University of Southern Maine. And Anne-Marie Ahern founded the Midlife Conference. And that is happening in Rockport later this month. She is a writer and also with Saltwater Farm Cooking Schools. Share your comments and questions. Send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now is Carrie Levine, who is the founder of Whole Woman Health, and she's going to be one of the speakers at the upcoming Midlife Conference. Thanks so much for calling in, Carrie.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for having me.
As someone who focuses on women's health, what do you see as the biggest issues that face middle-aged women?
That's a long answer.
Well, maybe a top five.
Top five. Irregular bleeding, mood changes, weight issues, sleep disruptions. I'll go with four.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what do you is this hormonal? Is this because of the pressures that women in the middle of their life face? What's going on here?
Well, yes to both of those questions, because the pressures actually exert real influence on our biochemistry. The ovarian hormone production is already starting to change. That is normal, natural, supposed to happen, not pathological, all good. And that ovarian hormone system is tied in to the thyroid and the adrenals and the brain. And so the adrenals being the primary production site for stress hormones, when stress is high, either because of years and years and years of neglect for all kinds of good reasons, maybe it's having children, maybe it's raising families, maybe it's raising careers, and then potentially compounded by caring for elders. Once that ovarian hormone production starts to shift, the adrenals can't compensate the way that they used to. So it's a little bit of a perfect storm or a convergence of things that are going on, which is why things escalate so intensely physically for women, particularly during midlife.
Hmm. What do you see as ways to help get through this? I mean, the stresses aren't going to go away usually.
They're not going to go away. That's completely true. And many of us have not taken the time to fine-tune our stress management coping strategies. So that's really the medicine. In addition to that, there is, of course, a big, big slew of options out there, and that can range anywhere from body work, you know, whether that's acupuncture or Reiki, all the way to hormone therapy and everything in between, nutrition, movement, et cetera.
Do you think a lot of this is a question of how we think about how we ought to be living our lives, how we think about control over factors that we might not be able to control?
Can you rephrase that question? I'm not sure I understand the essence of it.
Well, I think that a lot of people are possibly thinking that they should be able to control the things that they can't control.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's real, you know, and it's not always, I'm sure there's a better word for this, it's not always compatible. I think that there is a certain amount of surrender that can grace the transition. You know, I talk about midlife as a transition as opposed to a crisis. Like a crisis is just a situation that's not well managed. And I feel like midlife calls on all of our resources, our physical resources, our emotional resources, our mental resources, to tend to ourselves in a way that is unprecedented in our lives, because our physiologic resilience is different than when we were younger.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for calling in. Carrie Levine with Whole Women Health, and she's going to be the keynote speaker at the Midlife Crisis. Thank you so much. Bruce, as you listen to this and you listen to what women face in midlife, being the man who's on the panel here, what do you want to say about what is parallel and maybe different for men?
Well, midlife can represent a huge opportunity for men, I think. You know, there's going to be massive variation. It depends on the kind of household a young boy grows up in, and then later when they come of age. And so there's starting points that are very different. But to generalize a bit, midlife, because of hormonal changes and because of just the way we evolve as human beings and move into careers and raise families, some of us and so on, men have a really wonderful opportunity to shed some of the hypermasculinity forms of behavior, the performative parts of being male, at least cisgendered males. And, you know, on a far extreme, what we usually talk about as toxic masculinity can sometimes just not go away, but it can be slowly suppressed, and our greater, better person comes through eventually when we can shed some of the both culturally derived and hormonally derived aspects of like aggression, hot cognition, the tendency to be hostile or competitive, but not in a sort of nice way, just whatever that collection of characteristics that we call toxic masculinity. I won't say it falls away magically, but there is a lot of gradual but significant change in men, and they're growing, even if they're not aware of it, they're growing embracing of feminine characteristics, nurturing, communicative, self-disclosing, less, well, I don't know if it's too simplistic to say, less aggression and hostility that characterizes a lot of young men as they come of age. Again, depending on the model, the role modeling they got. So I think that's a really good area of discussion, is what kind of things fall away and allow men to be much more balanced. One word that comes up, and you can just, anyone could Google this and get a lot of rich information, is androgyny. It's normally a word people misunderstand to think like, oh, cross-gendered or transgendered, but it's absolutely not. It means a balancing out of the strongest areas of femininity and the strongest areas of masculinity, and having a balance. And I was looking at several studies. There's one recently, the NIH, National Institutes of Health, had a published a meta-analysis, a big, huge cumulative study exploring risk factors. Men and women who self-reported as having characteristics of androgyny tended to have the lowest risk for depression, anxiety, substance use, et cetera, cardiovascular disease. It went on and on and on. And you'll find that over and over again. So the men, but also women, can find a really wonderful convergence, not necessarily a crossing of our developmental trajectories, but men can become more feminine. Women can take on masculine characteristics that we associate with, say, ambition, leadership, et cetera. And that could be a really interesting and potentially wonderful transformation.
Susan, what would you like to add to this thinking and talking about the differences in genders when we come to midlife?
You know, I was thinking it was very interesting when Carrie was talking, how none of us as yet had mentioned biology or the sort of biological definitions. And she immediately began talking about menopause and andropause and the sort of change in the hormonal environment. And when I was listening to that, I was thinking, you know, I can't recall a more disruptive hormonal change than adolescence. That menopause is not our first whack at this disruption, right? The sense of things changing, body changing, and so forth. And what I think is so interesting about this particular age, and I don't mean the biologic age, I mean this point in time in our culture, is that a lot of these binary definitions of masculine characteristics and feminine characteristics and men and women are spreading out a little bit more. You know, androgyny is not something you you have to wait for middle age to experience. You have to wait until there's change in your hormonal environment. There are increasingly broader ways to be men, to be women. And I think that's a very welcome change. But I was very struck by the absence of biology from our conversation. I was glad for it because there's so much individual variability about midlife, about the experience of menopause, about the experience of adolescence, that it has as much to do, I think, with the environment, as Bruce mentioned, with personality characteristics, with resilience, and frankly, with one's level of socioeconomic comfort and the, you know, ability to be able to meet one's basic needs. So those were the thoughts I was having, Jennifer, as I was listening.
We'll go to Nathan calling from Camden. Hi, Nathan. Go ahead.
Hey there. Glad to be here. Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks, everybody. Full disclosure, this Nathan is actually the partner of Anne-Marie, one of your panelists today. And I'm just so delighted that you're talking about this. I'm also a co-founder and organizer of the Midlife Conference. And one thing that I would love the panelists to talk about, if they could, is an observation as a public health practitioner myself about the loneliness epidemic that really is confronting kind of all of modern society, but we hear about it more and more across our country, and not limited to, but particularly among men. And it becomes particularly pointed among middle-aged men and as they get older. I worry about this so much as I look at aging men, as it were, in particular in my own community or family. I worry about it for myself. And I'm really grateful for the institutions, including this radio show and including, importantly, the conference itself, which has given me so much in terms of richness in relationships and collaboration, about what we can do and how we should think about community building and connection as a bulwark against loneliness and its connections to improved health outcomes. Sorry, that was a mouthful. But
Nathan, thanks so much for calling. And I know that this is the number one concern of the U.S. Surgeon General. Bruce, interesting to me that Nathan talks about the loneliness epidemic for everybody, but especially for men.
Yeah, I think it's because men, I mean, there's one factor is traditionally, and there are lots of exceptions, but traditionally boys are raised in families, especially the more traditional families, and aren't given the sort of emotional toolbox for establishing meaningful relationships across time. One thing that's glaringly absent in men's relationships, I'm going to say glaringly not obvious, is intimacy. When men have very close friends, platonic friends, they want and sometimes can achieve the same level of intimacy as great friends among women, but it has to be covert. They have to sort of, there's a lot of parallel play. You'd almost use a childhood description of two people experiencing the same thing together, and there's a silent intimacy that establishes between them because they're simply both appreciating something. It could be fishing or it could be watching a movie or something like that. But something that is, maybe it's helpful to name it and make it okay to talk about and broach as a phenomenon between men, among men, so that they can be validated or, you know, have some kind of way of saying this is okay to do it this way. Maybe that's too difficult to get them to change their way of expressing closeness, but you can still recognize the ways they do achieve it and name it.
Yeah, Bruce, you have an email here from Bill, or there is an email from Bill and Nathan. Bill is thinking about the same thing you are. He writes, as someone who has passed through midlife, a couple of thoughts. Build your social network. You will need it later. Save assertively, but maybe not aggressively. It is never too early to wind down your debt. Take care of yourself. Good health now will bleed into later life. Remember that your profession and work is only a job. It does not define you. So, Bill, thank you for that email. And what I'm noticing is our guests nodding. And on that, we're going to take another break. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about midlife. What are your insights or what are your questions for our experts? Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You are listening to Maine Calling. What are the priorities and opportunities of being middle-aged? How do we find balance in midlife? Joining me, Bruce Thompson, who is a USM psychology professor at, say, Dr. Bruce Thompson, Anne-Marie Ahern, one of the founders of the Midlife Conference, and Dr. Susan Wary, geriatric psychiatrist with UNE. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. Susan, we've had so many conversations on Maine Calling and society in general about the anxiety epidemic among young people, especially the Gen Z. I see it personally in many of the young people I know. Is this something that is also reaching into the midlife years?
It really is. And, you know, it's accompanied also by a unique health anxiety that has now been defined as the number two health anxiety impacting middle-aged adults. It's a phenomenon that's been called dementia worry. And it's a phenomenon that seems to come about when middle-aged persons, I observe their parents usually, but maybe their friends, maybe their professors, showing some element of cognitive decline, and or they have a family history of dementia, say, due to Alzheimer's disease. And they begin to attribute every bit of forgetfulness, every lapse in memory, as that they're developing dementia. And I can't tell you how often I get asked this. Do you think I have dementia? Do you think I have dementia? And I'm very keen to ask you, Anne-Marie, at your previous conferences, has this been a theme, this notion, a unique health anxiety of dementia worry, second only to cancer?
Wow, that's incredible. It wasn't, I would say, a theme at our last conference, but one thing that was very much a theme was a lack of sleep, which resulted in sort of a fuzzy brain or forgetfulness, increased anxiety. And we did talk quite a bit about, we had a sleep scientist actually come and do a talk with the conference guests about getting more sleep and the science of sleep. But I have actually been hearing a little bit more of this through different avenues. So I'm glad you brought it, up.
We'll go to Kitsy calling from Portland. Hi, Kitsy. Go ahead.
Hi, Jen. I had the most amazing experience. I was 40 and I was a single parent and I needed to figure out what I was going to be when I grew up. And I went to a conference on Star Island, a writer's conference, thinking maybe that's what I do. And a woman who had extrasensory or psychic powers, which her husband had told me about, came to me and said, I know what you are to be. You are to be a Unitarian Universalist minister. And I just said, I did a Moses trip, you know, no, not me, pick somebody else. And she said, I know what you are to be. And a year later, I applied to theological schools. I got in, and I was by that time getting, between 40 and 44, 4 years, like going back to college. And I hadn't been to college for 20 years. And it was the most amazing thing. It's like I had a whole reboot. And I am still, I'm in my 86th year, and I still go one Sunday a month to one of our congregations and lead worship. But it was such a calling, and it was like I was starting all over again. And I just never had a sense of midlife. I had a sense of a renewed life. And it's just been, what a joy. And I just thank Nancy Mariotti, who was my call, my burning bush.
Kitsy, what a wonderful story. Susan, what do you think of Kitsy's story?
I loved that story. It really says about Mitzi that you, and this I think is a message maybe we want to give, is leaving yourself open to that opportunity is what allowed you to, I think, pursue it. I think, Jennifer, you just noticed my sort of enthusiastic nodding about this, because I think that that story captures what we've been talking about. Whether it comes to you in a flash, whether you're Saul off your horse and turn it into Paul, or Moses, as you said, that being open to the possibility of growth at any age is what you embraced. And whatever other elements it had in it, I don't know. But kudos to you for being willing and being open.
Anne Marie.
Yeah, this notion of how important the possibility of change is at midlife is a really constant theme throughout the conference. We're speaking to a number of people this year and last year who have made some pretty significant shifts, whether it be career or health-wise, at midlife. And this year, we're actually talking about the power and possibility of psychedelics helping you change your mind about the direction you're headed. So this is, there's a lot of interest in this subject and a lot of curiosity about, you know, it's never too late to fundamentally change how you see yourself and how you put one foot in front of the other.
It's interesting because we've talked about how people use the phrase midlife crisis. And I think we've also touched on the idea that some people feel as though they are stuck. But Bruce, there might be good reasons people are stuck. Maybe they're in a job that provides health insurance and they have a sick child, or maybe they, there's a gazillion reasons. You may not be in a position to consider dramatic change. Help us, for people who are not like Kitsy and are not able or willing or in the mind space to dramatically go back to school and change careers, how to confront this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the feeling of being stuck or trapped is very, very common. And it's central to that earlier theory we were talking about earlier, Erickson's theory of generativity versus stagnation. It's precisely the negative aspects of this period. And by the way, a plug to back to the midlife conference, Amy Bonsall, is it, who I think she's one of your speakers, she's giving a talk on the art of getting unstuck. So that's something that I noticed and it sounds wonderful. But my very first reaction to the concept of being stuck makes me think of socioeconomic status and privilege, wealth, affluence versus diminished resources, under lower education, fewer resources, and so on. If you're from a well-off, highly educated family, you may experience a midlife crisis, but it may come within the context of financial support, an educational foundation that gives you tremendous resilience, and family support and so forth. So you may see it as a transition into frightening but exciting new chapters in your life. But if you come from a background where you have not had those affordances, lower socioeconomic status and really poverty may really exacerbate a normal journey through feeling stuck and then eventually moving on. But think of jobs that people sometimes have for their entire career, which potentially could be a minimum wage, no growth job that, yes, they have the freedom to leave, but depending on the job market, they might come into their 30s and 40s and 50s and just see a future trajectory that just shows no opportunity for change. And I guess my heart goes out, my sympathy goes out to people who don't necessarily have the support system to explore what the new you can be, what the new chapter in your life can and should be. So that's a big area. It's a big unfair world in that sense.
Yeah. And could a new you not have to do with changing jobs, but just changing what you do with your weekends or the little bit of time you have in the evening?
Well, absolutely. That's a really important and optimistic way to say it. Assuming you have blocks of time that are free. This brings up something that we may have time to talk about, which is the sandwich generation phenomenon. And that might be experienced very differently among people from higher socioeconomic backgrounds versus people who come from more working class, lower earning backgrounds, about caring. I mean, the term means caring for grown children who aren't yet launched, and yet at the same time caring for elders, your older parents who may be highly needy. And that may dovetail with that in terms of this idea of a transformation or getting unstuck.
An email here from Melanie. To have been online on message boards and chat programs for almost 30 years, I have created a wonderful network of friends from across the United States. I've met some, and some I have not. They've carried me through difficult times, and they've shared joyful times. I often wonder when I hear conversations about loneliness if that will be enough if I'm ever in a situation where I'm not surrounded by people in real life to help support and love me. How different are these relationships, and are they fulfilling what we truly need? I'm curious to hear what the panel thinks about this. I'm going to toss to you, Susan.
You know, I think it's really interesting about the online environment. What I hear from the person who wrote in is a critical piece of this is that you've been doing it for years. And the lifelong friends that people form in chat rooms or online messaging or whatever strikes me as very much akin to a very old-fashioned thing called pen pals. And I know of people who were sustained through their lifetimes by pen pals they never met, people at a distance. Does it help in the very real world to have real people around to pick up your groceries, to deliver meals? Absolutely. But the emotional connection that you can establish with relationships that you sort of take seriously as opposed to just friending randomly can be quite fulfilling, as I think you've discovered, as the caller discovered. So I don't dismiss the multiple ways we have of connecting. I think the critical element here is authenticity and longevity. And those don't have to end because we have more technological ways to do it.
We have an email here from Lynn. There seems to be some confusion about the biological terms, male and female, as being used today with the psychological concepts of masculine and feminine. For the layperson who does not understand the difference between male biology and masculine psychological traits or archetypes, please briefly discuss. I think it will help clear up some confusion. Psychological androgyny is different than gendered androgyny. So, Bruce, I'm going to let you address Lynn's email.
Okay, well, a good starting place is just to sort of begin with the biology of sex. That does have variation. There are things called intersexualities, which may be too long a story to get into now, but generally we can agree that male and female is a chromosomal status with its secondary sex characteristics that follow and the hormonal differences. But there's huge, huge overlap. Like if you drew two bell curves showing, say, spatial reasoning, comparing men and women, males and females, you'd find massive, massive overlap and almost meaningless differences. So we have to be very careful about, you know, very reliable but minuscule differences that are about sex differences. But then gender, of course, we're told in our courses in psychology or even back in school with sex ed or something, that gender is something that is fluid, that it's partly cultural, it's partly a performative, meaning you adopt what your gender ought to be based on what you've heard around you, the way you were socialized. It's something very personal. It can be very private. You can have a private sense of gender identity and be something slightly different outwardly. So gender is highly fluid. It's absolutely on a continuum and a very, very broad continuum, and incorporates both dimensions of masculinity and femininity. Picture a dial on a dashboard or something. You aren't high in femininity and therefore low in masculinity. You can be high in femininity and high in masculinity and all the other combinations you could dream up.
Well, thank you for that. Anne-Marie, we have about a minute left, and I just wanted to ask you what you hope people come away from the midlife conference understanding, feeling, and what did you find last year that you hope carries forward and even grows this year?
I think what really resonated about last year's conference is how many people felt like they were able to get some difficult questions answered. And they felt that we had created a space that was safe and a place they could be vulnerable. And it's really helpful to get perspective in midlife because you generally only speak with your spouse or your friends. When you're in a room full of 100 people, and you're having an open dialogue about communication with your partner or saving for retirement or helping your parents to age, you learn so much because there's so many voices. And that is what made the conference feel so special to us and why we decided to do it again.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're having these conversations that our society sometimes is discouraging us from having in groups and keeping private, whether it's how to do your finances or how to talk about how your bodies feel. Both of those are things you don't really talk about at dinner parties.
That's true. Yeah, for sure.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being on our show today. That was Anne-Marie Ahern. She is a writer, founder of Saltwater Farm Cooking Schools, and a founder of the Midlife Conference in Rockport from October 25th to 27th. Dr. Susan Wary, a geriatric psychiatrist and director of Aging Maine. She is an associate professor of geriatrics at UNE. And Dr. Bruce Thompson, a professor of psychology at USM. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue, and we had technical help from John Bradford and Dan Works. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we talk with political experts about the vice presidential debate that is going on tonight. We want to hear your reactions. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.